History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And we've learned they don't have to go untold if we'll just take a little time to ask some questions and, more importantly, have the patience to listen to what comes back our way. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And I know that's going to be the case today in North Las Vegas, Nevada, with 99-year-old Jim Parker. He's going to turn 100 next March. And you grew up, Jim, in McAllen, Texas. Now, Texas is a big state. So tell us all where McAllen is and what that was like growing up there with a brother and four sisters.
The simplest way I have telling where it was, you take Shreveport, Louisiana, and Highway 180 came through and went through the Dallas-Fort Worth area, Mineral Wells, and then Jones County, Anson, and the county seat of Fisher County, where I was born and raised, Roby, Texas, and it comes on west of Snyder, and that highway eventually goes through El Paso and comes on out the west coast. So you take that, get to Anson, it's about 12 miles west of Anson. When Highway 180 was built in 1936, it cut the northwest corner off the farm, and the only way we had out before that was sandy, narrow lane, a half a mile to get to the next road. We were really country hicks and loved it. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, we got a paved highway, route to 180 right at our front door, so to speak. The farmhouse was 100 feet from the south shoulder of Highway 180 there, south of McAllen. It was a 160-acre farm, that's a half mile square, that my father's mother and dad homesteaded. Mm. And then grandfather passed away, and so my grandmother turned it over to my father. We had a fruit orchard, which was a plus, peaches, apricots, cherries, plums, and pears. We farmed with horses, so we usually had 8 or 9 horses. We had milk cows, so we usually had 8 or 10 of those. We raised pigs, so we had our pork or milk or beef, did our own butchering. It was a very educational life. At McAllen High School was probably the smallest high school ever in Texas. I graduated in 1939. May, and it was obvious there was no way to go to college. So I started battling my father, who says, well, you're not 18, you can't go anywhere yet. So I turned 18, I enlisted in the Army Air Corps, reported to Kelly Field. They were asking enlisted, because they had the enlisted pilot program just begun. Did any of us want to be pilots? My buddy and I that went in with, we both did. So we both went and took the flight physicals and then the written tests for pilot training. And we got letters about 2 weeks later, as I recall, saying we'd been approved for pilot training, standby for class assignment. Buddy got in permanent party, so he was staying at Kelly Field. I was in a new organization that's being trained to go open up new fields. So I believe it's late July, they sent us to Mentor Field, Bakersfield, California. Mm-hmm. I got a picture over there to show you barracks before they had streets, dust 6 inches deep. But after I got through with all the pilot tests and everything, then came KP. So I'm standing there in the kitchen and washing those big old aluminum pots they cook potatoes in. That sergeant come around and said, you don't look too happy. I said, how in the hell can I be? I came in to fight a war and you got me washing pots. He laughed at me and he turned around and he says, you're serious. He says, what else can you do? And so he took me in to the back part of the kitchen, and they just brought a half of beef in. That's the way they delivered to the military in those days. He says, you know anything about how to cut up a beef? I said, you got about 10 sharp knives and somebody to keep them sharp for me? Yeah, what are you going to do? I said, is that table available? So I had them take it off the hook and lay it on the table. 35 minutes later, it was all cut up and stacked and roasting steaks and ribs and what have you. And I said, this you can grind up and make chili out of. Where in the hell did you learn all of that? I said, from birth. Anyway, they gave me a PFC, my fifth day in there, because of my ability with cutting up a beef, I guess, was the real story.
Who knew when that was going to come in handy? And that makes me wonder. We'll get back to where you are there. But growing up on that farm, I'm sure there are a lot of chores or duties that you had that most kids don't encounter today.
Yeah, we get the seniority down for, I was the fifth of six children. I had one sister that was younger than myself. And initially, I was assigned to my mother to gather the eggs, to build a fire in the oven and a stove cook. We had wooden cook stove. She was using the boiling pot. I had to build a fire under it and get that thing on and keep it just the way she wanted it. And I developed a knack of finding woods for the kitchen stove, cooking stove, that would ignite quickly and were hot. You know, we're ready to give you the heat. Then, of course, the other duties were to help with milking the cows, slopping the hogs, feeding the cows, feeding the horses, being sure they got the water. That was a very dry area in there. We had a well about 200 feet north of our property and the neighbor's property, but he titled that well to my father. We had a cistern where you bring the water off the roof during rain showers into the cistern, but it was dry most of the time. So we used that well water for all animals and family. We usually milk five or six cows every morning, every night. This has to be done at a certain time before daylight and after dark, usually.
Mm-hmm.
Except you don't milk at night, so we had to get in just before dark on the evening. At 5 years old, I could harness up a team of horses.
5 years
myself,
old?
Myself.
Wow.
Hitch them to a plow, a cultivator, a planter, or a wagon, and go do whatever was to be done with that equipment. And my dad thought he was good with animals, but I had the animals on my side. They knew I liked them, so they were always, my brother and father would walk into the lot in the morning to hitch up three teams. Here come all the horses to me. And I'd chide him. I'd say, well, I'll tell my brother to be good to you today. I'll tell my dad to be good to you. And horses, when they're playing with you, they have to get behind your back while you're talking and then give you a big push with their nose. You can talk about poverty and hardship, but if you take all the surroundings, it probably was the most phenomenal way to grow up that there was on a farm.
Well, and I'm wondering if the horses liked you because they thought you were one of them. I heard you slept in the barn for a while.
Oh, I did. My mother didn't like boys. She had four girls and two boys. My brother and I rarely slept in the house more than three nights a year. That didn't bother either of us. Fresh air was good for us. In good weather, we'd sleep under a tree. Bad weather, we'd get in a storm cellar or go to the barn. Yeah, they thought we were part of them because my brother and I, we were sleeping in the barn more than we were in the house. And animals are a lot smarter than you give them credit for. I don't know where I'd what you'd call it, soft hands or what, but the old cows, my dad and I walked into the milk lot at the same time, they all came to me. I talked to the animals and they talked to me. He's asked me quite a few times, well, how did you know how to learn this? I said, everything I know was taught to me by a horse. They are work animals, and they know it, and they know how to react to treatment. It's an education just watching an animal for 5 or 10 years.
Hey, what about the Great Depression? Because so many people I've talked to who lived through that, and you were a child when the Great Depression hit.
Right.
Did having the farm insulate you from some of the effects of that?
Well, to be honest with you, in my analysis, it totally... I didn't feel anything. Everything was the same. We worked with the animals. Of course, we had fruit, which most people didn't have an orchard around. And we butchered calves and we butchered dogs. And I had a pretty easy life as far as food goes. I don't know what a box house is, but you build a base, a 2x6 base, and put flooring on it. And you take 1x12s, start them at the corners, and then you run a 2x6 deal around the top of that. But the house is just that 1x12 board between you and the outside. And then they put a 1x4 shiplap over the cracks in the 2x12s. You had pretty cool winters there in that area. We have snow about every fourth or fifth year. Survival was to be ready for whatever was going to happen before it happened. My mother didn't let the girls get out and do farm work. She didn't mind sending me as 3 or 4 years old out to milk the cows, but the girls won't have to do that. I probably have more education from natural sources than did from school, because Macaulay was, put it this way, the last on the educational requirements of the state of Texas. Kind of drew a picture to me that there's no wall too high to climb, too rough to succeed. And I told my dad I wanted to go in the military. He was of the opinion that all they were in the military were dope addicts and drunks. I didn't believe him then, and when I went in the service, I found out that that was less than 1% of the military. But as I told him, I said, at least they've got different fields of work so I can learn how to do something.
Well, and you mentioned, you know, when you enlisted and then you signed up for the opportunity to be a pilot, that that was a goal of yours.
Yeah.
How early did that thought arrive in your mind that maybe someday you'd like to fly?
I started at about 6 years old, and for a couple of years there, and don't ask me why, then the fever went down. I had too much work to do, I guess, and which was good. As soon as I graduated from high school, well, as soon as I turned 18, then I was the boss, not my dad. He was a gentleman, but he had a lot of things to learn, like all of us do, particularly in family life. But when I got to the Army, I looked at the guy wearing a star on his shirt. He learned how to get things done, or he wouldn't be wearing that star. So I don't worry about what I don't know. I worry about what I'm learning and how to use what I'm learning.
Mm-hmm.
But that kitchen, it took me less than a day to show them everything I knew about cooking. And they taped it, and they taught it to the newcomers as they come along. But that's neither here nor there.
Before you go any further, I'm curious, is there something you look back on from your childhood or something that, you know, before you joined the Army that was a spark that was lit for your desire to fly? Was there something that turned you on to that idea of maybe flying someday?
I never saw an airplane. We didn't have magazines or newspapers. It was just looking back on it now, I think that God just set me up. That's what I wanted to do. Of course, I didn't listen to him. I only did it for 50 years.
I'm sure there's more to that story. So you show them what you can do butchering that side of beef. They put you to work there in the kitchen.
I got out of the kitchen there and worked in a radio shop, changing out radios, and then they put me in the control tower. When I got to Metro, the control tower was full. And that's where I went to the fire department initially. And then when that fire department horror story was over, they sent me out to the flight line. This is my schedule. Monday morning, I report flight line to staff sergeant that was flight chief. He assigned me as the third man on an aircraft maintenance. Now, this single-engine pilot trainer, the Vultee BT-13. Anyway, the first day, I was third man on the crew. I went to work Tuesday. I was second man on that crew. I go to work Wednesday, and here's a sergeant stopping me on the way in, and he says, "Hold it." And he introduced me to two corporals. He says, "These two guys just finished the Army Air Corps aircraft maintenance course at Chanute Field, Illinois. And they're going to be your assistants." And he takes me over, and he shows us the airplane we're going to maintain. So that's my third day on the flight line. I'm a crew chief with two assistants that outranked me. I thought, well, that's all going to happen this week. So go in Thursday morning. Here came the sergeant flight chief. "Since you got these two guys been through school, I'm going to give you two airplanes to crew." Friday, so I'm about that time I met Joyce and stuff.
Yeah, tell me about that. So it's a really good thing that you got sent to Minter Field, because there was someone very special for you to meet there. And if you hadn't met Joyce and the three children and four grandkids and seven great-grands and two great-great-grandchildren wouldn't be here. So how did you meet Joyce?
I always kept a buddy in the chaplain's office. So he called me one day and he said, "Chaplain, it's arranged an off-base party He told me to ask you to get as many of your buddies as you could to go, because he promised me to have a bunch of young GIs over there at the party. So it was in a farm home right at the edge of Shafter. It really wasn't out in the country. Huge house. The living room was as big as this whole house, I think. It was the senior girls' class that was throwing the party. Joyce was president of the home ec club. So I'm there, and these kids and girls coming around, and they're talking and yakking, sound like my sisters. And all of a sudden, I thought, that's my buddy. I said, if I had my eyes closed? And he said, no. I said, well, that girl wasn't sitting over there on that couch the last time I looked. Well, later on, I finally analyzed that she was in there helping her buddy's mother with getting the goodies that they were going to feed us that night together, being she was president of the home ec club. So I jump up, shoot myself here, and I go over and introduce myself to her. She wasn't impressed. But she was a very honest, direct person. She wouldn't lead you along for anything. Before I got up to walk over to introduce myself to her, I knew right then that that was the female I wanted to marry. And I hadn't even thought about marriage before I saw her.
How in the world could you possibly know that? You hadn't even talked to her
know.
Yet.
I've had those hunches through life, and I played them out. They've always been the best way to go. We visited, started feeding us, so we were eating. I asked, could I take her home after the party? She was a little slow. Finally says, okay, I guess that'll be all right. I know now that then she was running everything she had on me through the lines to be sure that there weren't going to be any mistakes made. The party ended, and I had a little 36 Ford coupe with a rumble seat. One of my buddies had gotten a date with the daughter of the family we had the party, Alberta McKinley. I said, well, Joyce, you and I are riding a rumble seat. Benny and Drive, she didn't want a rumble seat, but we got up in front of her house, and they had a fenced front yard. Helped her out of the rumble seat and over to the gate, asked her to get her phone number to call her for a date. That was it. Next morning, a couple of my buddies and I were in town playing the pinball machines, was the thing that we did then in spare time. And this man walked up to me and said, are you dating my daughter? I'd never seen the guy before in my life. He was exactly the same height as me. And it turned out, as we married, he's the same weight. I said, who's your daughter? And he said, Joyce Townsend. I said, I'm guilty. He says, okay, from now on, I don't want to see you around my house. We were standing there face to face, nose to nose. I said, sir, I want to tell you something. You got it all wrong. I've already fallen in love with your daughter, so nothing's going to change that, particularly you. If she accepts, I'm going to date her. So I'm going to show up there. What are you going to do about it?
Wow.
It's amazing. The rest of my life, we married, and he and I really struggled at first. He thought he could run over me, and he found out running over me was like having a major wreck. All of a sudden, he was my buddy.
It's time for our first break. I sure hope you're enjoying this spirited storyteller as much as I am. You can check out photos and a short video with 99-year-old Jim Parker at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And we'll be right back after this. If you're a business owner, I've got a phone number you really ought to take down, 800-989-1139. And when I say business owner, I mean businesses of all shapes and sizes, from the multinational chain to the hot dog stand on the corner, or my personal preference, the taco truck. 800-989-1139. Because you can have the greatest product or service in the world, the best business plan, the most capable workforce, and still not maximize your potential if you don't have a reliable, efficient, and versatile plan for processing payments. 800-989-1139. That's the number for my friends at Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in the country. Why is Provident growing so fast? Because they're committed to helping your business grow. 800-989-1139. That nonprofit you love that relies on donations? Provident can even connect you to a special software platform to streamline and stimulate giving. If you are ready to grow, give it a go. Go Provident today at ProvidentPayments.com or call that number, 800-989-1139.
proudly presented by Provident Payments. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 99-year-old Jim Parker of North Las Vegas, Nevada. Originally from McAllen, Texas, he had never even seen a plane before he enlisted in the Army Air Corps. That was before the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. But Jim would end up logging over 23,000 hours in the cockpit in his life, flying 22 different aircraft models. But as he told us before he left off, the most important development during his assignment at Minter Field in California's Kern County was meeting the young woman with whom he would enjoy 78 years of marriage, his late wife, Joyce.
Well, that was October 29th, 41. We married October 2nd, 42.
Wow.
I was gone 2 months to Hemet, the primary pilot training, February and March of 42. Come right back to Minter Field for basic, where I'd been a crew chief, and now I'm flying the airplane. And then I go to Stockton for advanced. We were set up to get married in base chapel with a chaplain on graduation day on a Friday. So Joyce came up, and of course they were moving troops, and she got bumped on her schedule. And for a while, I thought maybe she's not coming. She showed up, and I had a motel room for her. And I said, "Okay, it's too late now. It's 5 o'clock in the morning. First thing, we'll go to base, and I'll get all of our paperwork." You know, there I was in Stockton, and I got my medical and everything, and I had to send the application for the marriage license to her. Back, the clerk had it, but he wouldn't issue the license. Friday afternoon, we got started on it. Saturday, we all day long, we even had a couple of judges come down and say, "You know kids that lied to you because you've known them all their life. You took their word for it. This guy was honest with you, and now you're not going to help him out." I says, "Yeah, I can be cannon bait for the Air Force, flying an airplane, get shot all to hell. That's okay, but I'm not old enough to get married." Anyway, then we wound up with Sunday. Of course, her parents were expecting us to get married on Friday. My parents were, and neither family expected us to hang out together because we didn't.
Right.
I was going back to the barracks to sleep, and George says, "You're going to stay right here in this room." So I slept in the chair, and she slept in the bed. And we behaved ourselves. That's why we were married so long. But finally, wound up Monday morning, I got orders to go to Salt Lake City. It didn't take us very long to get everything in that 36 Ford and head for Reno. We get over there, had a window out, so I couldn't leave our stuff in the car while I was in the courthouse. So we got a motel room, put our stuff in so it'd be safe. We went to the courthouse, and the county clerk, old gal, got the marriage license. She kept looking at him. She says, "You kids want to get married now?" Neither one of us said a word. I guess we both nodded. She said, "Meet me at the next door down there. I got to close my window, and then I'll come out there." Walking across the main floor to the stairs to the up second floor where the judge's office was, there's a guy coming down the stairs. We get there, and she said, "Jose, turn around and follow us. You got to be a witness at the wedding." So she takes us in and gives judge a marriage license and introduces us around. And he says, "Well, let's get with it." Anyway, I forget where Joyce was last. I was like, "You take this, I guess it's me, a woman to be your lawfully wedded wife." "I do. I don't pronounce you man and wife. $7, please." I turned and I nosed up that old son. I says, "I don't think I'll pay you." He says, "You what?" He says, "I don't think I'll pay you." "Why?" I says, "You could have taken a breath between $5. And I said, "I'll be back next week to give you your second lesson." That was the beginning of our marriage. We go to Salt Lake City. It's a replacement center. It wasn't an organization I was going to be assigned to. We sat there a couple of days at a motel room downtown. I went to leave the base to go to the motel, and the guy wouldn't let me out the gate. And I says, "I got a brand new bride down there. I've got to get off base." "Well, you can't go." About 30 minutes later, they put me on an old 6x and a bunch of other guys, trucked us down to the train station. Well, lucky or unlucky, it was about a block from the motel. I get on there, and none of the military people listen to me. And I saw this civilian conductor, so I went to visit with him. He took me in the car behind the one I was put in. There wasn't anybody in there. He says, the only thing I can tell you is this damn train won't leave the station until you get back. he puts me out on the other side so they wouldn't see me. There's only a block or two to the hotel. So I at least got to go tell her I was running off and leaving her. So the Army owes me a 36 Ford coupe with a rumble seat. Never paid me for it. Joyce had to go back to Shafter because Blythe in World War II had a base there, and of course everything was taken up. But I had a doer there help me, and some guy bought a bunch of real small trailers. Of course, they weren't making big ones in those days. And he set them up in a lot and hooked up all the utilities, and he was renting them out at a very reasonable price. So we go down and look, and we rent one of those. But you almost had to call signals any time either one of you moved. That was our honeymoon suite. We just got settled in, and they said, well, we're moving the whole group to Oklahoma City. So they took wives and children and put them on buses and sent them. They put us on a troop train, which took twice as long. But they had looked ahead. They had a hotel and a restaurant that the Army owned and was running there in Oklahoma City. So dependents were put there, given room and ID to use the restaurant. And we get in there 3 or 4 days later. Then we start looking for apartments. Some old shop. It could have been a barber shop. It wasn't a very big shop. It converted into an apartment downtown. That's the only thing we could find. We didn't have transportation, so we rented that. The second night, we knew we was in the wrong place. They hollered at them at the base and told them I needed a little help here. At least they gave me a Jeep for a day.
Mm-hmm.
And we went out in the northwest neighborhood of Oklahoma City at the time. This house had a sign, the upstairs apartment for rent. Two-story. So an older couple showed it to us. This lovely place. The kitchen was awful small because it was put in, you know. We rented it, and I think they were as happy as we were that we rented the apartment. They said, get rid of that Jeep. We'll get your transportation to the base and back. My perfectly good car is sitting in Salt Lake City.
Well, let me ask you, too, because I'm just, you know, hindsight now.
Yeah.
As I hear you tell that story, it wasn't easy for you guys to get married. There are a lot of wrenches that got thrown in the way. Did you ever think, hey, maybe this is a sign and we're not supposed to get married?
No. She never had a negative thought, I don't think, and I know I have. If it's been done, I can do it.
Uh-huh.
If she was the same way, if it's been done, she can do it. Everything went along fine. By the way, I graduated from pilot training and promoted to staff sergeant. So all this stories I've been telling you, I was staff sergeant. On February 1st, 1943, they cut out all of the specialties and enlisted men. And they knew they made a mistake with the enlisted pilot program. They took all of us staff sergeants and promoted us to flight officer, which is equivalent to a warrant. Of course, we had to change uniforms and all of that jazz. So one day I was staff sergeant, next day I was a flight officer. Next day I had orders to go overseas.
Well, that happened fast. And there's a lot of things I need to come back around to for you so we understand. The only reason I asked about the hurdles to you getting married, I mean, you guys had to go to great lengths. You're waiting days. It's not happening. You go to Reno. You finally get it done. And I'm sure some people would say, well, the odds were against you. This isn't a marriage that's going to last. But it lasted pretty long, didn't it?
The odds are going to last 100 years, I can guarantee. He's promised me a big party if I stick around for 100.
Well, you don't have too much farther to go. But before you lost your wife, you'd been married 78 years.
78 years.
That's pretty impressive.
If you find anybody else got those numbers, let me know.
Well, I guess I should ask you now, how do you do that? What's the secret to being married for 78 years?
Love is wonderful, but you got to like each other. There's a difference between love and like. Most lovers think that they got everything covered, but something pop up in front of them and they got a problem. We decide we were going to get married. See, like me, that was a lifetime commitment. There was never any thought of divorce. It never came up, even in our hottest arguments. We always hugged and kissed after it. be sure it didn't interfere with the way we wanted to live. Like all marriages, all of a sudden she's pregnant. I'd been TDY down in Louisiana getting gunnery for my two gunners on the aircraft, and they called us back to Oklahoma City, told me, you can go see your wife, you got 1 hour and you got to get back. So that's when I told her I was leaving for overseas that afternoon. She says, well, I'm pregnant.
Wow.
And this couple, bless their heart, they were heartbroken. I said, don't you worry about her. We'll see that she gets to wherever she wants to go. Because I only had an hour to get back to Will Rogers. They had me on a C-47 with a bunch of other pilots to Tulsa, which had an A-20 plant there where they assembled A-20s. We picked up a new airplane, flew it back to Oklahoma City. And then my two gunners and I packed all of our stuff in there, military, civilian, everything we had. 5 o'clock that afternoon, took off. A lot of them started buzzing the airfield, and I took off. I got the hell out of there and went. We're going to Barksdale, Louisiana. I went down Shreveport the next morning over to Mississippi. It's just be a refueling stop, but a guy had an engine fire on one engine and got his gunners out, and he was flying the airplane away from town. And when he jumped out, he was too low. His chute didn't get open, So we lost an airplane and a pilot in Meridian, Mississippi. Three or four of us stayed over with good friends of his and helped get arrangements made with his family.
And I know I keep hitting the rewind button on you, but there's a lot of little elements of your story here that maybe are something you've told so many times it's no big deal. But as I gauge it with the perspective of the normal World War II experience, there's some unique things about you. For one, you're one of the last guys alive who entered the military before Pearl Harbor. I know Minter Field is a special place for you, and there's still a museum there in Kern County in California where they preserve some of the history of guys like you who were there training. It's special because you met Joyce there. But another thing happened while you were there.
Pearl Harbor.
Yeah. Every veteran I've interviewed has some kind of memory of that day, December 7th, so I'm pretty sure you have one.
Unique as it is, three of my buddies and I, one rich kid from Ohio, he had a Chrysler Imperial, brand new one, 41. We'd gone to church in downtown Bakersfield. We came out and there was the police everywhere. Any of you soldiers? And we weren't in uniform. We held up our hand and get to base as soon as you can. So we jumped in the car and go out. They didn't have a fence around the base at the time. They had a guard shack at the entrance, but they never had a guard there. But boy, we get back there, and guard runs out and stops us. Where are you going? And the guy knew me personally. I said, we're going to the barracks. Get the hell out of the way. It was actually in church in downtown Bakersfield. Pearl Harbor was hit.
Yeah.
In my analysis, that had some effect of all the different things that happened thereafter. Don't ask me why, but I'm a strong believer in the old boy upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one that made me put me on earth. He's the one that's going to take me when I give up. But he likes people that have their own opinion and will go for it.
Mm.
Whether you believe that or not, but that's a strong belief of mine from God. He wants you to be the individual you are. I know so many people trying to be like so-and-so, trying to be like, and you hear that story. But I had a free ride, the way I see it, all the way. So Larry Benner, and I don't know how far I got the story, the first sergeant called me in on February 1st, said, now you're a buck sergeant. Call me later, and you're going to Hemet to start pilot training.
And what was that like? Because you told me, you know, you had never even seen a plane before you enlisted in the Army
service,
Air Corps.
Yeah.
So to get in the cockpit for the first time, did you feel something?
Oh, it's happening. It's happening.
Uh-huh.
That confirmed in me that anything is possible. That's how I felt. Anything. You may think you understand the kid growing up on a country farm. We never had electricity. We never had running water. I was lucky. My brother was lucky. Our dad didn't keep us out of school to help with the farming. Of course, we worked before we went to school, and we worked after we got out of school. He figured that was good enough, so we were pretty lucky we weren't interrupted in high school. Now, I graduated from high school in 1939, and I swear that I have everything I know today in me at that time. Because I haven't run into anything that surprised me.
And once we hear some of the circumstances he encountered during 53 B-17 bombing missions during World War II, that's going to be quite a statement that he made. It's break time again, but there's much more to come with 99-year-old Jim Parker. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. 33-28.
When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, where we try to fit a World War II veteran story into 1 hour on the radio, but that isn't always possible, and I've realized that this is going to have to be one of those rare occasions where we really need multiple episodes to tell the story. So plan on hearing more of Jim Parker's memories, especially the full story of his most harrowing World War II bomber mission on our next episode, but we're going to squeeze as much in as we can today, and I want to say a big thank you to Belinda Morse of Honor Flight Southern Nevada for connecting me to Jim, a decorated B-17 pilot with the 301st Bomb Group in World War II, who went on to a long career in aviation and even has fond memories of shuttling Frank Sinatra around in a Learjet. The next plane Jim is going to climb into is a Stearman biplane in September when the Dream Flights organization stops through Las Vegas on its barnstorming tour, treating World War II vets to aerial adventures. Jim's first cockpit experience came in Orion PT-22 in Hemet, California. How confident were you, Jim, that you knew what you were doing?
Call it dreamer, because that's what it is. Strong dream that you can force it into reality. I've always had an open door to God. He's always talked to me anytime I want to talk to him. I don't know about you, but he talks to me in my language so that he's sure that I understand what he's telling me. When I told him I was going to pursue Marion Joyce, he gave me an A+ or something. So I knew I was on the right track. But we had just perfect life. It couldn't have been any better. Mm. She didn't want to be Miss Big Somebody or Miss Little Somebody. She wanted to be Joyce Parker.
And is flying something that you did take to pretty quickly? Did you get the feel and the hang of it pretty quickly?
This little British guy had been in the RAF and fighters over there in England before. I guess he had a breakdown. So they let him out, and he came to Canada, and then he got in the U.S. And this is Ryan's School of Aeronautics out there at Hemet at that time, and he was working for Ryan. He was real good with aero work. Man, I could do the 50 snap rolls, vertical reverses, and all of those things. In fact, the Army checkpoint says, I've never seen a primary student that had the detail that you have of all these maneuvers. He was a little guy and I was big. They broke us up because they put me up for elimination. I flunked the civilian ride, and I go get this Army check pilot, and he's about 5'4", and probably 140 pounds soaking wet, and he was always jumping up trying to put his arm around my shoulder. We go out for the check ride. He starts the engine. He taxis the airplane all out. He runs it up. He does the takeoff, he does the flying, he does the landing. So I knew I'd washed out. I hadn't even touched the airplane. I'd jump out and get my parachute and head for the barn, and he says, three-striper. He says, don't you know how to report to the officer when you're leaving? Yes, sir. So we walk in arm in arm. I figure it's over. So we'll go in the next morning. Nobody's saying anything. The manager says, okay, you have a new instructor today. And here's this big bruiser like me. And the damn airplane couldn't get us in the air. Once we got in the air, we didn't dare do rolls or maneuvers because it stalled out on us. I went into the civilian that ran the school for Ryan. I said, this guy can't be my instructor. I weighed 205. He weighed probably 210 or 215. You can look at it. It wasn't.
PT-22.
It was comfortable for a 150-pounder. My head stuck out so far that I got all the slipstream. But I graduated anyway. They held me back a month. I wound up being a student of the guy that ran the school.
Gotcha.
And he knew what he was doing. I probably learned more about flying with him 30 days than I did the rest of my life. He wishes me good luck. I get ready to leave, and they said, Commandant Cadet wants to see you before you go. So I ran his lieutenant colonel. He said, I just got a message from Pentagon, and it's going to take 5-10 minutes here. I want to go through it properly. I said, have at it. I'm not in a hurry. He said, first of all, you remember that written test you took when you was applying for flight school? I do. He says, they told you if you flunked it, you could take it again? He said, you aced it. You're the only guy that's ever taken that test in the Army Air Corps that aced that exam. So the Pentagon thinks you ought to have special consideration. We can change your status from aviation student to aviation cadet. That way, when you graduate, you'll graduate as a second lieutenant. And then he went on with all the other things. I looked at him and I said, you know, I thank you and I thank the Pentagon, but I like the way things are going that way. He says, well, it's yours. And I said, thank you. And I left. I get the mentor. I get an instructor, and he was introducing himself to all of the 5 students he had. He gets to me. He says, well, I've seen you before. I said, well, I suspect so. I said, you remember that aircraft that somebody broke the strut on? You had to fly a test flight after I replaced the strut. You invited me along. So it was a mistake. That made him believe I knew how to fly the airplane. I knew how to maintain it. I knew how to fly. He never flew with me. And I come up for my 20-hour check in this Army check pot. Of course, everything was Army at Mentor.
Yeah.
He says, oh, I hear you're quite a pilot already. And I said, where in the hell did you hear that? He says, well, it's floating around, your instructor particularly. I said, by the way, what's his name? He said, what do you mean? I said, hell, I don't ever see him. He said, what do you mean? I said, he's never flown with me. I said, I asked the other students what he taught them that day, and then I go out and try to teach myself the same thing. He was a captain. He really got upset. I said, now, don't go get him and the base commander together. get all of us together. Everybody that's got a word put in here should be face-to-face when we settle this thing. And so he did that. He called me and said, we got a meeting in the commandant's office, and I show up. Everybody was picking on that instructor because he didn't fly with me. And I said, well, he can tell you I don't need to know. I don't have any battle to pick with him. But get off of his back and give me an instructor. So they gave me a new instructor, and we hit it off. Had a ball from then on. My 40-hour check, he says, now you're what they told me you were earlier. Only better. Up to do their manor, and then off to Stockton I go. And I get up there, and we get this little guy, and he says, now the first guy calls me the lieutenant, whatever his last name was, gets washed out. I'm Elmer, and that's all I want to hear. He was probably 5'9", good 145 pounds. And I'm standing there 6'2", 204 pounds. But the only thing he taught us to do is formation. And I swear he saved my life several times through the years because I knew how to fly formation. When the airplane you're on the wing of blows up, you got to have an alternate plan, not then, before it happens,
right,
but after it. I went to the Douglas A-20. Of course, that's a single pilot, no navigator, no bombardier. And then I flew one to North Africa. And I get over there, and they put me on that B-17 crew as a co-pilot. And he wouldn't even start the engines because he didn't want to fly it. And I made him start the engines and do the run-up.
Well, let me ask you about something first. Cause I'm just what I try to do is put myself in your shoes, right? And so I'm thinking about it. Here you are. You talked about the life you grew up with on the farm, never even seen an airplane, no electricity in the home. You end up as a pilot, and by the time you're 20 years old, you have your wings, you have a wife, and as they tell you you're going overseas, she tells you she's pregnant. So you're leaving, you're going overseas, and you've got a pregnant wife that you're leaving behind. Did that weigh on you, concern you at all?
No. Only because it was Joyce. She was the most assuring thing that you ever saw.
What about just the possibility? I mean, you've
no,
already...
No, like I say there, God promised me if I behaved that I would be taken care of. I told him when I married Joyce, I said, we're not two, we're one. So anything you're going to do for me, you're going to do for her. That's the only way I'll buy it. And I don't know why, but I was perfectly at ease. The biggest scare, fear, or whatever you want to call it, I never was afraid of anything. I had fears, druthers, other things I'd rather do than others. But I got down to Natal, Brazil, twin-engine bomber, two gunners in the back. We had interphone, but you couldn't see each other, you know, and talk to each other. The bomb bay was filled with a fuel tank, and it's 5-6 hours to Ascension Island out in the South Atlantic. All that water, and I'm a Texas farm boy. You talk about your eyes open. My eyes were open that day. Fortunately for me, I got an airplane with the best ADF radio in it of all of them that were. My buddies wouldn't even half perform what mine was doing. So I wasn't quite halfway across the Ascension when I'm already picking up the Homer over there on the island. So I knew I was staying on course. We had navigators take all the winds and everything, and they came up with a one-heading course, so we didn't worry about wind or whatever, just the tailwind factor, which changed our ground speed. But I never was so glad to see a little pile of rock in my life as I was.
You're not the first pilot to tell me that journey to Ascension Island was pretty nerve-wracking, trying to hit that spot after that long of a journey.
Yeah, it was hardly big enough for a runway, much less parking. And we were all going to stay 2 or 3 nights because out in the middle of the Atlantic had to be nice weather. They had us out of bed at 5 o'clock the next morning, got us fed, and get the hell out of here. They didn't have a lot of room for airplanes.
Sure. Yeah, they had to keep you moving.
And we went up to Monrovia, Liberia, and went from there west to Dakar, sucked everything out. Well, we did this in Florida. Our fuel burn, our oil burn, and everything. And of course, I'd get that 6-hour run to Ascension. I figured, well, nothing can happen now. I'm over land from here on. I'll take off from that car, and they had two emergency strips they'd briefly some. And just as I was coming up on the called ATAR emergency strip, something got my eye on the instrument panel. I looked, and my oil pressure was starting to, on one engine, fluctuate. And then all of a sudden, pew, zero. So I feathered the engine, and I'd already made a mind I was going to land on that strip because I had enough altitude. If I didn't have an engine, I could make it. Just as I got that one feathered, the other one did it. So instead of feathering the other one, I unfeathered, turned final, and landed it and got it off the runway. And we get out of it, and those engines were smoking something fierce because they were hot. Went out to pull a prop through, and it's frozen. So I had an emergency landing. I didn't know it was really an emergency until afterwards.
Woo. Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
Donna needs me.
Thank you, sir.
I'm just going to let it run.
Okay.
I'll get it later.
You want me to stop anything when we're done?
For a couple hours.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I don't think we'll go quite that long. Okay.
But here, we're sitting there, they got a building about 8 foot square. And they did have fuel. So they came over in a Jeep and picked us up. I said, how did we get the hell out of here? And he said, there'll be a C-47 stop in the morning. They'll pick up you three guys and all your belongings and fly you on up to Saleh Airport in Morocco. So that was my closest thing to emergency, but I really didn't know I had it till after I got on the ground.
Yeah.
I knew I had problems, but...
That could have been a lot worse.
I had painted Joyce Ann on the nose of the airplane. In fact, that newspaper down there, open it up there. See a picture of me and my two gunners with the Joyce Ann. We left her there. About 2 months later, a buddy of mine came in and landed, and he had the Joyce Ann. They'd changed the engines, and he was coming through on a C-47. And he says, hey, that's Jim Parker's airplane. He says, you fly? Yeah. Would you fly this one up to Morocco for us? So he jumped in and brought it up to Saleh Airport in Morocco, and we got reacquainted, but then they came in and reassigned all of us right after that. That's when I got assigned to the B-17.
Yeah, and I hate to keep coming back to one idea, but when I asked you if it concerned you at all to head overseas and leave a pregnant wife behind, you said no because it was Joyce. But here I'm also hearing you say that just before that, you'd seen a fellow pilot of yours killed in a training accident. You know, before he even went overseas,
yeah.
And you know what's happening overseas, that there's anti-aircraft, that there's enemy fighters, yeah. There's any number of things that can happen to a pilot, especially this early on in the war. So there was no thought in your mind that you might not come back and see her and your unborn child?
I grew up with a wonder if I was a coward or not. And when I got in the military and I got in the A-20 and I started overseas, I said, well, I have a feeling this airplane's going to tell you whether you're a coward or not. And when I got to Ascension Island, I knew I wasn't a coward. And that all disappeared then. But she was such a solid citizen that I knew that she would take care of herself. Of course, she went back to Shafter. I knew she wasn't going to go home with her mom and dad because she was too damn independent. And she found her little one-bedroom apartment there in Shafter, got her a doctor, and she had our son. He was 5 months old when I saw him the first time. The cute thing there, I flew from Italy to Casablanca. I got on a ship in Casablanca. Within 2 hours after I landed, a hospital ship coming to Newport News, Virginia. And I get off there and I get a good old American meal. Cute thing happened. I'm a farm boy. I'm a big milk drinker. And so it was breakfast. They were serving us breakfast before we left. And I picked up 2 half-gallons of milk and set them down on my plate. And here comes this little 5'8" second lieutenant. I'm a flight officer. Nobody knew what the hell I was. It's like a warrant officer bar, but it had different colors than warrant officer. He picked up one. He says, you can't have 2 of these. I grabbed him by the seat of the pants, and I said, turn around here. I said, you don't look like to me you've been overseas yet. I don't believe you got your pants wet yet. I said, you put that half a gallon of milk back down there, I'm taking it. I'm a flight officer, in case you wonder what I am. That's the unknown between enlisted and commissioned. But I've flown a full combat tour, and I'm going to take all the damn milk I want. And you don't have a thing to say about it. And here comes the mess sergeant, and he saw immediately he wasn't going to get in his house. So, in fact, he came by after I'd finished the first one and said, you want me to get you another one? I said, no, two's going to do it. And then I get on a train, of all things, at Newport News, mm-hmm. to Fort Ord, California. And I get to Fort Ord, I get off. I said, how the hell did I get to Bakersfield? We don't know. I said, do they have a Greyhound bus come through here? Oh, yeah, we'll take you to the station. Fortunately, I got there just as the bus was ready to pull out. Got on, get to Bakersfield, and how the heck did I get to Shafter? He said, get a cab. And I thought, boy, a cab's going to cost me a fortune, you know. I got it and got my stuff in. I get there and I knock on the door, and Joyce makes it. And she was twice as beautiful as I remember. Then I hear the baby crying, so we go in there. And he was really upset that there was a man in their apartment with his mother. And he's 5 months old. They were really close. And they always were. He just died last year. But I never was as glad to see anybody in my life. That's when my emotions cut loose that you were asking about earlier. Mm. That was the ultimate security, Joyce and I together.
Jim and Joyce enjoyed 78 years of marriage together, but the reunion we just heard about would have never happened if Jim did not survive December 19th, 1943, a mission that would earn him the Distinguished Flying Cross and leave many wondering how in the world he brought his crippled B-17 in safely. We'll hear the story of that mission and more of his aerial exploits next time. Don't forget to check out the photos and a video with Jim online at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. You've heard what kind of storyteller he still is at age 99, so make sure you join us again next time for what it's fair to say are his most miraculous memories. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.